This is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctor's Digest. And in this special volume, we're going to be focusing on the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, that disastrous landmark decision which has so divided our country and caused the death of over 50 million unborn babies. I want to give you some information that is inspirational as well as factual to help you understand where we are on this issue, the trends as we move forward in fighting this, and how you can communicate better with your patients and with the public at large as they look to you as an expert on this issue. We have some special guests joining us, Gianna Jessen. She was the inspiration for the October Baby movie, and her story will move you. Priscilla Coleman will be giving us some information on depression in women who've had abortion. Brian Stilwell will be talking about the Endowment for Human Development, a wonderful group giving us superb tools to educate people about unborn life. And then we're going to be joining John Wilkie. John is, well, the patriarch in the fight against abortion. He started even before Roe versus Wade and has guided Christians involved in this issue for many, many decades. John is going to be joining us to give us some historical perspective and some practical ideas as we go forward on how we speak out on this issue. This volume of Christian Doctor's Digest is going to be not only one you want to share with others, but also one that you're going to want to keep. It has such important information. It'll be an ongoing resource for you on this very important issue. Gianna Jessen does not quit. She's the inspiration of October Baby. You may not have seen the movie, but I bet you heard about it. And her story will inspire you as she talks about her gift of cerebral palsy. Let's join her and see what she has to say. Gianna, I want to thank you for joining us here on Christian Doctor's Digest to tell your miraculous story. Share what God has done throughout your life, starting before you were even born.
I was born clearly to shake things up and to be somewhat unconventional here, I think, on this earth. I'm 35 now, just turned 35. I dreaded the idea of my 30s, my entire 20s, and I'll and I am more fully alive now than ever. So anyone who is stressing out about age, never fear. But anyway, I am adopted, and my biological parents were 17. My biological mother went to Planned Parenthood and was advised to have a late-term saline abortion. I don't believe they are performing those anymore because they were having so many survivors of that particular procedure. But she went in, and I didn't die. I was that baby that she was trying to end the life of. But I was being burned alive for approximately 18 hours in my mother's womb. And I was literally born in an abortion clinic. How many people can say
that I know of.
and so I was born in the clinic, 6 o'clock in the morning, April 6th, 1977. Beautiful spring day. And they didn't know who they were trying to kill. They did not know that they were messing with God's girl. I literally am his girl. When your father and your mother forsake you, the Lord will take you up. And for any skeptic listening, it says right across my medical records, born during saline abortion, and that I weighed 2 pounds. The abortionist had to sign my birth certificate.
Wow.
Which, I just think it's phenomenal on the part of God, because as much as I do believe he is full of love and mercy and grace and all of those things, that I believe that just drives him, the love of his heart. I also believe there is this Braveheart, blue war paint on his face, side of God, warrior side of God, that in that moment just looked at that doctor and said, sign here. You will acknowledge her life. You will acknowledge her life. So it's amazing because the only reason that I'm alive, and all of this is grace, of course, but the only reason that I'm here is that the abortionist was not on duty yet for work. 6 o'clock in the morning. Wasn't there. So the nurse called an ambulance and had me transferred to a hospital, and that's how I'm alive.
Wow. Wow. What a story. And what happened next? You got to the hospital. Your parents didn't want you. The abortionist had tried to kill you. How did God continue to intervene?
Yeah, have a little bit of trauma. Have a little bit of
kind of tough beginning.
But one thing that does not define me is that of a victim mindset. I do not subscribe to victimhood. I am a victor, and I really cannot stand the mindset that we are cultivating in the culture and around the world, that you owe me and you better give it. You know, no, the world doesn't owe me anything. The Lord has done it all and will continue to do so. Then I'm placed in the incubator in the hospital weighing 2 pounds. And they said, there's no way that this baby girl is going to live. And I kept living. So after several months of not dying, they concluded at that time, they said, this baby girl has a tremendous will to live, and she does not want to die. And they were right. But here's another thing. I was being burned alive by the solution in the womb. So it should have blinded me, burned me, you know, suffocated me ultimately and ended my life. I am not burned. I am not blind. I sing. I have every intention of singing with Andrea Bocelli in Italy. And it's just astonishing that the only effect of this is the gift of cerebral palsy, which was caused by the lack of oxygen to my brain while I was surviving this procedure. So, but what I wanted to say was I believe that in that time, the Lord was holding me in the womb, that he was being my mother and father, and he was speaking very gently to me and keeping me safe. And I believe that though that fire of sorts was to snuff out my physical life, in that time, I believe he instilled in me a very different sort of fire of an eternal kind that will never be vanquished and cannot be vanquished by anything on this earth. So that will he instilled in me. And I often speak to parents with strong-willed children, and I say, you know, I know it's difficult now. I was one of those children, and I was often shamed for my will, but it is in fact this will that gives me the grace to stand up as a light in the midst of absolute darkness. Without this kind of will, there would be no way I could stand. And so to comfort any parent listening with that sort of child, your child most likely has an immense destiny. So the will doesn't need to be shamed, but rather guided.
Well, what happened after the hospital? I mean, obviously they didn't leave you in the incubator. At some point, the next steps took place on this incredible journey that God had planned for you. What happened?
Well, then I was placed in an emergency foster care, and it just was not a healthy situation to stay with my biological parents. Very, very broken people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was placed in emergency foster care. Now, okay, look at what's happened so far. Now I'm placed in this temporary home, and these people decide they don't like me. I'm like, okay, how old am I? I've just been trying to be born. I mean, oh, good grief. And they just decided they didn't like me. So they would shut me in a room for extended periods of time. And I've been told since by an incredible team of health professionals I work with, psychologists, that that's tremendously traumatizing for a young baby.
Mm-hmm.
So I was taken out of that home and placed in the beautiful home of a woman by the name of Penny. So by this time, I'm 17 months old, 32 pounds of dead weight, diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Everybody's saying to Penny, Gianna will never progress beyond this point. She will be a vegetable forever. And Penny was respectful, but she didn't believe them. And she went home and she prayed for me. And she did my physical therapy 3 times a day. I began to hold up my head, sit up, crawl, walk by the age of 3 and a half with a walker and leg braces. And I'm here today without a walker and leg braces. Now, I do have this little limp and have some balance issues that we're working on. But that is extraordinary since my prognosis was horrendous. And I went on to run 2 marathons, the full 26.2 miles, Nashville in 2005, London in 2006, by praying my guts out and running on my toes, because that's the only way I could run. But I had a lot of rage. I've since had 5 years of therapy. But at the time, I needed to work out a lot of anger. So I did it through these 26-mile runs, and I learned so much. God is just so kind and good. But, I have this limp. What's interesting is, you know, when you're little and you have cerebral palsy, you're an inspiration and you're just so special. Okay, that is encouraging till you're about 12. Then when you become a woman, you still are told how inspirational and special you are. But it makes your for a time, your dating life a living hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I will tell you this, that God has been so amazing because, it's almost like it's been one of the most painful sides of this journey. Is in this culture in particular, if you have any kind of physical, small limitation, it's like, it's unacceptable. And the message is, great, you've overcome and you're such an inspiration, but you didn't overcome enough to be loved.
Mm.
And that really is what you face most of the time. And so I had a meltdown, and I will wrap it up, but I want to get this story in because it might really help someone listening. I had a meltdown before God, and since he's my only father, because I was later adopted, but I was adopted by really broken people. Although the beauty in that part of the story is that my foster mother, Penny, became my grandmother because I was adopted by her daughter. And so this woman, the only one that I ever had the opportunity to bond with, is now my grandmother, who is nearly 90 and has cared for 56 foster children,
wow,
of which I was one, and she did this as a single woman. So anyway, back to the limping and the dating life. It's just been astonishing. So I had this meltdown before Jesus when I was 30, and I had been dealing with a weasel, and I classify men in 2 categories, the uncommon man, which is pretty self-explanatory, the brave heart sort of man, which is whom I will marry, a John Adams sort of man, or the weasel, which is also very self-explanatory.
I like your categories.
And so I was crying and then just weeping, and I'm like, Lord, fine, is this all there is? You know, because the weasels of the world just do not see me. They don't even care. I'm just special, and that's just breaking my heart. And I said, you know, is it just preaching forever and then I die? And here you make me a woman, and that's nice. I appreciate it. And I hear that voice that I love say back, Gianna, I know you have dealt with this your whole life. And God was meaning rejection on one level or another. And he continued, but Gianna, sometimes I use the very thing in your life that is ripping your heart out to do one thing. And I said, what? And it was just that emphatic because I am that honest with God. And I heard him say, protect you. I use those little limping legs of yours to blind certain men to exactly what you are, cause them to think that it is their decision, when in fact, I am turning them away because I am your father and I will not hand you over to just anyone. And for the first time in 30 years of living, I thought, oh my goodness, this does not mean that I am repulsive as a woman, that God thinks that I am beautiful and that he will give me a beautiful soul of a man, too. And it was amazing. And then since, I've considered a gift because my legs sort of act as a net to be a fisher of men. It's amazing how many people want to know about Jesus when you are limping in front of them.
Hmm. God uses everything, doesn't he? He doesn't waste suffering. He doesn't waste pain. He doesn't waste anything in our lives and gives us an opportunity to reach out. How did October Baby happen? How did this story and the movie come to be? Because it's given you such a wonderful platform to speak out of life, to affect other people. Tell us that story.
It's really funny how it came about because I wanted nothing to do with it.
So you were screaming as God dragged you into this, right?
Yeah, it was totally hilarious because that is so how my life is. I'm like, no, I am not interested. And then and the Lord, because he loves me so much and he's my dad, he's just like, okay, we're going to just wait a while. I'm not going to, you know, everything will be fine. You'll end up doing it, but I'm going to give you your thing. One of the reasons is because there's so much to me and it can be frustrating at times to just be loved and only loved for your birth.
Right.
When you have so much inside. But anyway, so that was one reason. So I ignored it. I ran from it. I heard from it about it for 2 years. Ran. Then I'm at a crisis pregnancy center fundraising banquet. I'm about to go up and speak, but just before I do, I am sitting with these two great brothers, and one of them says, "Oh, Andy says, you know, we've just been working on a film called October Baby," and if you could have seen my brain, just the eye roll. I mean, I just was like, oh gosh. But then I knew that God was speaking to me, and I knew that I was placed at this table, that I was meant to run into these two men, the Irwin brothers who made the film. So long story short, I took me 2 months to watch the first version of the film. It never crossed my mind that it would be because it might be a little bit painful.
Mm-hmm.
Never crossed my mind. And the story, I didn't even know until I was involved in the film that I even inspired it. So they're like, you know, you inspired the film. I go, what? I had no idea. Honestly, I had no idea. And then I watched it, and I laughed, and I cried, and I healed. And that is exactly what I told Andy. And I knew that was God and that I was to get fully behind this. And then I ended up singing in the film, which I had no plans of doing. They just happened to be at my house and hear a song I was about to go record. And that fits perfectly in the cathedral scene. We're sticking it in the film. And so that's how it all came about.
Wow. What doors has that opened for you? I know you do a lot of speaking, a lot of traveling, and you speak out so eloquently on life issues. What's the result of the film been for your ministry?
It's just been a lot more truth-telling, a lot, you know, just different. I can't really think of one, maybe not enough coffee at the moment, but I have been doing a lot of work in Italy, and they are incredibly receptive to this message, and I've just been going over there. I may be spending extended periods of time over there because of the work, and they're just loving hearing Jesus and all about Jesus and his love and for them. And so that's been remarkable. And they know all about October Baby. And then just before I went on the air here with you, I just got a message that the Pope has said something.
Oh, my goodness.
About me, I guess. I don't know if it was this morning, wrote something in the Vatican newspaper, and I'm like, oh my good heavens. And if you could see me right now, I mean, you would just smile, because I am the most unlikely individual to have any of this happen. I mean, I don't go snooze. I don't go. One thing I want to say on my tombstone, among many other things, is she didn't manipulate. She just prayed for things and God did them. I just don't want to live a life of, you know, let me see if I can make the right connections and let me see if I can. No, I have the connection. His name is Jesus, and he's able to do everything. And I just love saying outlandish things like, I'm going to sing with Andrea Bocelli, have half the world not believe me at all, and then watch it happen. It's my favorite thing.
I want to hear that recording when it happens.
It's going to be the doxology.
All right, all right. And nothing better could be said than that. Gianna, thank you for spending some time with us. You are delightful and inspiration and encouragement and God and a humble servant of the Lord. And that's the most important thing, nestled in his arms. And it's going to be exciting to see what's happening in the days ahead. We want to keep track of that. But thank you for your faithfulness and letting God use you. There's nothing more precious than being in the center of God's will and with him having you taking you through life. It's just a marvelous thing. And it's been a blessing to me and I know to our members to hear you today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
If you've got an iPhone, I want to recommend to you that you download on iTunes a new app called CMDA space PAR. PAR stands for Prescriber Resource. This is a great little app for your practice because you can easily prescribe good resources to your patients. And here's one that I think is especially helpful. I'm pregnant, now what? Heartfelt advice on getting through an unplanned pregnancy. And boy, this would just be a tremendous help as you see a young teenage girl or even a married woman where she's dealing with an unplanned pregnancy and trying to decide what to do. If you don't have an iPhone, you can just encourage patients to give us a toll-free call at 888-230-2637 or go on cmda.org to get this resource. You know, one thing I really admire is bravery, and Priscilla Coleman has plenty of it. She's a professor of human development and family studies at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and she has been doing research and speaking out on the psychiatric and psychological implications of abortion and has been publishing widely. One of her articles recently was in the British Journal of Psychiatry, a study that incorporates data from over 800,000 participants. This is the largest study in the world on the mental effects of abortion. And she's going to come on and give us some tools to put into our toolkit as we speak out on this issue. Let's hear what she has to say. Priscilla, it's so good to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. I know you just spoke at the Women in Medicine and Dentistry Conference, and I've heard great reports from that. You've tackled this issue of the psychological, psychiatric impact of abortion. What caused you to move into this area in academics? That is not without peril.
Well, it sort of evolved slowly. I guess if we had to go back to the very beginning of my interest in the psychological effects of abortion, it stems from an experience with a roommate actually in college who underwent an abortion over Christmas and then experienced a full-blown psychotic break. I knew very little about abortion at that time, very little about psychological disturbance, and it was just a frightening experience for an 18-year-old to sort of watch this transformation. And it did, once it was resolved, the abortion was identified as the triggering event. I know now that cases like that are extremely rare. There's very few documented in all of the literature. So that sort of left an impression on me. I was born in 1961, so abortion was legal most of my life that I remembered, and so I really hadn't thought about it much, but that really started the wheels turning. And then when I went back for my master's degree in the early 90s, I, you know, of course, had to find a topic. I was interested in attachment, and we had adopted our daughter, and so research interests were sort of ill-defined, and I had very good experiences with the faculty. It was at James Madison University, and so after I completed the master's and I really looked at adjustments to parenting, I didn't look at the abortion issue yet at that point, and then I was hired at JMU to teach and to get involved a little bit in research with some of the faculty. And so I started a project with my former thesis advisor looking at young women's experiences with abortion, but also looking at college-age men who had been involved in an abortion. And so we collected data on about 1,200 people, and we found some interesting things, most notably that the men were experiencing similar levels of depression and anxiety compared to the college-age women. And this is a high-risk group, obviously, if young people are involved in their studies and they have the idea of fitting in a baby. It's difficult if you're in college. And so I think college students are often pressured to abort. There aren't options in dorms for housing babies and so forth. So that kind of got me thinking the data. I had the data. I went on to get my PhD in lifespan development in 1995. And my advisor there really didn't want me studying abortion. And it was so politically incorrect of a topic. She tried to steer me, you know, totally away from it. And so my dissertation dealt with parenting and some of the other attachments and the other interests I had. And once I finished up, I began to write up some of that data that I had collected at James Madison, and then just started studying this stuff. I really didn't care if it was politically correct or not. There were so many people studying parenting and attachment and the other issues that I was interested in, and no one would touch this topic. And by this time, I was in my 30s, I had known women who had had abortions and had suffered from them, in addition to my roommate, you know, way back in my college years. And so, you know, I just knew that the suffering that women were experiencing was not reflected in the literature. There was so little that had been published, and the studies that were out there were poorly done. So I just thought, you know, this needs attention. Nobody wants to do it, and that might as well be me. And so, and it just became very interesting, and not only the content, but the whole process of trying to get well-done studies published. When I published papers on other topics, they would often, you know, go right through the peer review process with very little difficulty. These papers get just raked over the coals, and it's so hard to get published. And so I learned a lot about the process of publishing and about other agendas that intersect with our efforts to do the science. And so it really just has been a process. So I've been actively, you know, publishing for the last 10 years or so on abortion and mental health. And just recently it's become, we have shifted more to looking at how abortion affects relationships and parenting.
You just had an article published in September of 2011 in British Journal of Psychiatry, and it caught my attention. I think it's caught the attention of many other people. A large meta-analysis of the literature out there. Tell us about what you did, the methodology used, and your conclusions.
Because the studies published prior to about 1995 were poor in that there were small samples, there were very few controls for third variables, there were a lot of shortcomings. So around mid-90s, the research that was published tended to be just better work. And so choosing from 1995 to 2009 was a little bit arbitrary, but mostly based on being able to find studies that fit the criteria that I laid out in order to I basically wanted to get a snapshot of the literature, but focusing in on the very well-conducted studies. And part of the reason I chose to do a quantitative synthesis, a meta-analysis, was because there were several reviews that have come out in recent years, one by the American Psychological Association in 2008, and it was unbelievably biased and poorly done. And when it's a qualitative review, there's much more room for bias, and they were very clever in how they eliminated large portions of the literature. There are 40 studies that were just European studies that they didn't even address. And, you know, they crafted the review so that a particular type of study would only be from the U.S., and then another type of study was throughout the world. And there was no rhyme or reason other than, from my perspective, an effort to whittle down the literature to a bottom line conclusion indicating that abortion is no more traumatizing or stressful than an unintended pregnancy delivered. And that bottom line conclusion was really based on one study that was conducted in England. And it was absolutely ridiculous and so flawed methodologically that I thought the only way to trump this APA report is somebody's got to do a meta-analysis. There has to be a quantitative review of only the top studies. And if we really want the information that practitioners need, that women need in order to make informed decisions. And so I had never done a meta-analysis, but I bought meta-analysis software for $95. And over Christmas a couple years ago, I just sat down and it was very easy to use. So I put in, there were 22 studies that were incorporated with 36 effects, close to a million participants. And it was very systematic, very revealing in terms of the outcomes. I restricted it to anxiety, depression, substance use, and suicidal behaviors. And I was able to do separate meta-analyses based on the comparison groups. So some of the studies involved unintended pregnancy delivered as a comparison group. Others were just a pregnancy delivered. And then those that just the comparison group was women who didn't have an abortion, weren't pregnant at the time. And so I broke it down and, in all of these studies, I had very strict inclusion criteria. The samples had to be over 100 participants, a minimum. Many of them had thousands, many more than that, but a minimum of 100 participants. They all had to have controls for third variables. Often you'll see in the media and elsewhere that, somebody looks at this literature, it's really just the women who had prior psych problems who are suffering afterwards. Well, women who have a pre-existing condition or a history, they are more vulnerable. That is a risk factor for having increased problems after an abortion. However, there are many studies, 12 of the 22 studies that I included in the meta-analysis had controls for prior psych history, and we still see that elevated risk for various mental health problems. So some of the studies controlled for psych history, others controlled for personal and situational demographic factors that might systematically be related to the choice to abort. So it's very important with this type of a design. We obviously can't randomly assign women to have an abortion or a birth, so we really need to control all other relevant factors. And so in doing that, we still have strong effects. But overall, women with an abortion history experienced an 81% increased risk for mental health problems. That was the bottom line number that came out of the full meta-analysis. And that's, with adjustment controls for all these third variables. And the results showed that the level of increased risk associated with abortion varies from 34% to 230%, depending on the nature of the outcome. And then when we look, for example, the increased risk was 34% for anxiety, and it was 37% for depression. For alcohol use or abuse, it was 110%. And then marijuana was high at 220% elevated risk associated with an abortion history, 155% increased risk with suicidal behaviors. That marijuana use abuse variable is interesting. There haven't been a lot of studies, but one of the studies that's incorporated in the meta-analysis was one that we published in 2002 in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and we found almost 10 times the usage in a later pregnancy among women who had a prior history of abortion. So I just think it's interesting, the substance abuse variable, whether it's marijuana, alcohol, or cocaine, whatever it is, it seems to be the strongest effect throughout the literature. And it makes sense if women don't have access to treatment, when professional organizations like the APA and the AMA deny that abortion carries this potential to harm women, there aren't treatment protocols that have been developed and tested. There are many faith-based interventions, but the average woman who's suffering from an abortion may not have a religious orientation and may feel shame around the abortion and may just not want to tell. She may not have told anybody. Some women will tell the partner, some will just tell a close friend, some won't tell anyone. And so substance abuse seems to be an easy remedy. You know, it's so widely available in our society. A woman can go to her doctor and get an anti-anxiety drug without explaining, you know, the source of the anxiety. And so it's an easy fix, but it's not a positive way to deal with it, and it may prolong the suffering. And so I just think it's fascinating that we're seeing that. And back to one of those qualitative reviews published by Charles and colleagues out of Johns Hopkins University was the research group, and they did a narrative review similar to the APA. And it was so interesting because they emailed me and asked if I would come up there and participate in a debate. And I said, I'd be happy to if we can open it up to substance abuse. I noticed you left that out of your review. You know, none of the studies involved substance abuse. And so all of these effects were apparent regardless of whether or not we were comparing women who had an unintended pregnancy delivered or a pregnancy that was delivered where there wasn't identification of the intendedness, or if it was just women who hadn't had a pregnancy, we still saw the effect. It was lower when compared to unintended pregnancy delivered, but still statistically significant. 55% increased risk of mental health problems when a woman has an abortion compared to an unintended pregnancy delivered. So this is counter to the APA conclusion. It's also counter to the conclusion that was just recently derived by the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I served as a reviewer on that document. I mean, anybody could send comments. I did an extensive review. I also provided an analysis to the APA. I was one of their chosen reviewers, and it was so interesting, not only what the conclusions distorted or represented a very distorted view of the literature, but when reviewers sent their comments, they were not incorporated or just very minimally incorporated. One of the other reviewers was a David Ferguson from New Zealand, who I've had a lot of interaction with over the years. He wrote my letters for promotion to full professor at Bowling Green, and he's actually an atheist. He's self-described as a rationalist, but he stands behind these data, and he's saying that this is systematic. You know, there is something that is clearly going on here, and women have the right to know about it. So he was just as annoyed by the APA's ignoring of, you know, his comments. He's somebody who's published over 300 peer-reviewed journal articles on substance abuse and child abuse and other topics, and he happened to have data on abortion. He went into his studies expecting to show that abortion really isn't harmful to women, and the data just, you know, jumped out at him. And he's an honest scientist, so he was demoralized that, you know, that the APA didn't use his elaborate feedback. And we found we had very similar criticisms. Both of us were saying that they should quantify the effects. Why wasn't there's plenty of literature now? Why wasn't a quantitative analysis done? The timing was in response to these qualitative reviews that are just so distorted. And I just firmly believe that women have a right to know what is the best evidence out there telling us about risk. And if women are in high-risk groups, we also have a very strong literature on women who might be more vulnerable to experiencing various mental health problems. We know that younger women, women who have trouble with the decision, women who are invested in the pregnancy or are pressured by others, are much more likely to have distress afterwards. There's a whole list of established risk factors that aren't even, like, being debated. Even the APA acknowledged that if women want their pregnancy or they're feeling pressured by others, that they're much more likely to have difficulties afterwards. So why don't women get this information? You know, yeah. it's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, and unfortunately we're seeing increasing bias in science on a host of issues coming from our professional organizations. One of the other conclusions, Priscilla, that I thought was so good to help us with this is where you talked about 10% of the incidence of all mental health problems. I mean, that is a huge thing.
Right. In order to say that, you have to calculate the population attributable risk statistic, the PAR, and using all of the data in this meta-analysis, it was like 9.9, almost 10% of all of the diagnoses, all of the people suffering from these various disorders, 10% is directly attributable to abortion. And so, you know, in terms of the economy, I mean, that's a huge cost in so many ways. And that number is, you know, similar to other PARs derived elsewhere in the literature.
What has been the response from these major organizations and other people to this report? And what has been your response to them?
Well, there's been a lot of different, I mean, the response has been varied. I was just finally asked by a representative of the Royal College to provide some answers to questions they had about the meta-analysis. It's so interesting because this journal is connected with the Royal College, and yet the Royal College came out with a review that was similar to the APA. It really was poorly done, and it seemed very biased to me. So now they're wanting me to get involved and answer some questions. I believe that my evaluation of their document that I submitted in June was pretty much ignored. But in there I said, I wish you had contacted me. I could have told you about the meta-analysis that's in press in the British Journal of Psychiatry. And I'm sure they probably did already know about it. But Peter Tyler, the editor of the British Journal of Psychiatry, is just a real respectable scientist. And at the end, I think he stands firmly behind publication of this paper. And honestly, I haven't heard anything from the APA. I mean, it's amazing how silent people are being in the United States about this, whereas in England, all the major papers covered it. I've been hearing from people all over the world wanting interviews and copies of the paper, and it's but the APA, the AMA, they haven't gotten any inquiries from them.
Well, I appreciate your, adherence to good science, going above and beyond, and your willingness to stand up. And I think one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to interview is not only get this information, which I think is very useful in dealing with patients, as our members do all the time, but secondly, to just have you stand as an example of David and Goliath. I mean, out there with your slingshot and your stone. And I just appreciate that so much. We need more courage. We need more boldness. And too often it's easy I won't talk about that because people will criticize me if I do, or it could professionally affect me or whatever.
Well, I just felt like I don't have any choice. No one else is, very few other people will do it. And so, and I just think about all the women who are suffering, and they don't, it's never validated. There's like, we're doing so many abortions in this country. I think it's up to 1.2 million. Yeah. And if 20% of those women have serious psychological problems, you think about the impact on themselves, on their families. I mean, it's too huge to ignore.
Well, Priscilla, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule and educating us, and for your stand. And I want to commit to pray for you, and want our members to as well, as you continue to stand boldly. God's power is sufficient, and that's where our courage comes from. It's not pulling up our bootstraps. It's depending on Him. So thank you for all you've done. May the Lord bless you.
Thank you.
You're seeing women in your practice every day who are suffering psychological problems because of the abortion they had, many of them years ago. There's some great resources out there, though, that can help you in dealing with them. One of my favorites is Sidna Massey's book, Her Choice to Heal. Finding Spiritual and Emotional Peace After Abortion. Another great resource is Kathy Wunnenberg's Grieving the Child I Never Knew. It's a devotional companion for comfort in the loss of your unborn or newly born child, but it's also very helpful with those that are dealing with abortion. Dave Beeble's book, If God Is So Good, Why Do I Hurt So Bad? And Dee Breston, The God of All Comfort, Finding Your Way Into His Arms. These are just great resources. Many of them are available on the Prescriber Resource app, or you can get them by calling our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. Well, Brian Stilwell at the Endowment for Human Development, the founding president and CEO, has put a wonderful set of tools into your hands. Brian received his BS in electrical engineering at Northeastern University, an MD from University of Massachusetts, did a family practice residency, and then 13 years he was in emergency medicine. But he left all that and is the primary researcher and author, as well as president at the Endowment for Human Development, creating some tools to help healthcare professionals educate others about human development. And the tools he has created are going to enable you to speak in medical schools, public schools, your church, and a host of other areas with great video, great statistics, great information that will enable people to really understand the unborn. Let's hear this story from Brian Stilwell, and he'll be talking about some of these groundbreaking resources. Brian, it's great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. It was just a few weeks ago you were here. We sat down, and you told me about the Endowment for Human Development. And I got so excited I wanted to get you on Christian Doctors Digest. Tell our members what this is all about, how it started, and then we'll kind of dig into what is there.
This started really in the late 1990s when a few of us became aware of this rare footage obtained inside the uterus of the living human embryo and fetus. And we thought, boy, this is such a great teaching tool that we want to share it with others. And so we began sort of a research phase of the project that helped identify what exact footage was available and what it showed. And we eventually put together a documentary just outlining normal development from fertilization to birth. We started a nonprofit organization called the Endowment for Human Development in 2001. And we've been just building and growing ever since as best we can, just preparing resources that really illuminate what goes on inside the womb, since most people really have little idea, and also teaching about the health applications of prenatal events and preconception events on lifelong health.
Well, and first thing I wanted to say to people is EHD.org, which is your website. You've got to see this, because what they've produced is so helpful to what you do in your practice and what you do in educating people. Tell us, let's start off talking about the video. I mean, you walked into my office, and here is a video that essentially you guys did, but National Geographic is selling all over the world.
Well, National Geographic is the distributor of the program in the U.S. and Canada. And the program, again, is called The Biology of Prenatal Development. It's a 42-minute documentary. It begins with fertilization and just goes through the developmental highlights from fertilization to birth. The majority of the program is focused on the first trimester, and even beyond that, the embryonic period, the first 8 weeks, when most of the interesting developmental milestones occur, as probably most of your audience knows. The real heart of the program is the rare footage that shows what's going on, and the living embryo looks very different from a dead embryo. The skin is transparent. You can see internal organs. You can see the beating heart. You can see the chambers of the heart contracting and relaxing with each cycle during certain phases. You can see the brain. You can see the developing eye. You can see the fingers and toes emerge from the hand and foot plates. It's just amazing what can be seen with this video.
What's neat about it is then not only is the video, which is a great tool, I can see that running on a loop in the OBGYN's office or being used in education or other ways, but then you actually extracted some of this best footage and anyone can put this up on their website. Tell us about that.
We have a page on our website that you can access by just clicking the Get Free Videos button in the header. And we basically took some excerpts from the video and made them into something called widgets, which are basically embeddable video clips. And it's a customizable resource where you can go and choose from any one of 14 clips. You can choose subtitles in up to 88 languages because we've translated the entire script of the program into all these languages. You can choose any width between 200 and 400 pixels depending on how much space you have on your website. And there's various other options you can choose, and then you can save it and review it. And if you like it, we give you the code to copy into your own website that will allow this video to play right on your website. And it's completely free. It takes really minutes to accomplish. And we even pay for the bandwidth, so it doesn't cost anyone anything to show these on your site.
Yeah, and it's just phenomenal video. I can't say that enough because it's just kind of wow. I've never seen anything like this before. So, you know, if you're doing any kind of maternity work or pediatrics or whatever, I mean, this is just phenomenal stuff, and use it in so many different ways. And then you went the next step. You hit Facebook. Tell us what's available on Facebook for patients.
We have a free Facebook app called the Little One Pregnancy Calendar on Facebook, and a pregnant woman can use this free pregnancy calendar to track her pregnancy week by week. It features the rare videos that we've already talked about. It has the interesting development facts week by week to help her better appreciate her little one. It also allows her to share her pregnancy with family and friends in a way that was probably never possible before. We also offer an estimate of the baby's heartbeat as pregnancy progresses. So there's a constantly updating heartbeat ticker that estimates the number of heartbeats since the heart begins to beat at about 22 days after fertilization. And it just gives people an idea, an education really, about pregnancy that most people have not obtained thus far in their lives. So it's a great educational tool. It's a great way to understand pregnancy yourself and to share that understanding with others. It's a great way to be motivated to make better health choices with diet and so forth. And it's all free, and it's on Facebook. And we just recently came out with an all-Spanish version of the calendar on Facebook as well. So that's available for everyone, and it's, again, free and just a great tool that we're eager for everyone to use and share.
I could see people putting this in their prenatal orientation materials and go to Facebook, download this widget, and, you know, follow your pregnancy. It's an extremely valuable thing for the woman, and makes the doc look good too because they've pointed them to it. And then there's this other, I mean, it just keeps going, the virtual human embryo. I mean, I was amazed what you guys had done with that as far as an educational tool. Tell our members about that.
Well, first of all, the virtual human embryo was not created by us. It was created by a collaboration between Dr. Raymond Gasser, who's at the Louisiana State University Health Science Center, and the Human Developmental Anatomy Center in Washington, D.C. And what they did is they took the best specimens from the Carnegie Collection in Washington, which is the largest collection of human embryos in the world. They found the best embryos preserved at each stage of development. They digitized and restored and magnified and labeled all of these serial sections of these embryos and put out an atlas of unprecedented quality that's now online. And they generated about 34 gigabytes of prenatal imagery. The research program took 13 years at a cost of $3.2 million to accomplish all this. We simply got permission to host it on our site, and we developed a comprehensive index and search mechanism to make this incredible collection accessible and easy to use. And again, it's up on our site and free for the taking, as they say, but it's a resource that has never been available before unless you are willing to get on a plane and fly to Washington, D.C. and look at these embryos there.
Well, and, you know, when you say index, that really doesn't explain. I mean, you know, Brian sat with us here at CMDA, and you can just go almost day by day watching development of any single different system or identifiable anatomy in this collection. I mean, the power of the indexing is just unbelievable. I forget what you told us, how many entries were in that.
Well, I think Dr. Gasser and his team applied something like 50,000 labels to all of these images. And so we basically took all these labels out of the images and indexed them so that search engines can find them. And then we made our own alphabetized index where people can search any term they want. And then we'll pull out all the slides from the collection that has the search term that they're looking for. And it just makes this incredible collection accessible in a way that we think people will find easy to use.
You know, your work has been used a lot of different places. We talked about National Geographic, but also now is being used by some states in their prenatal education, some of it required by law. Tell us about that.
Well, we were approached first by the state of Kansas, and they were reworking their website on, they had a Woman's Right to Know website, and of course our organization, we should mention, doesn't take any position on abortion or other sort of controversial bioethical issues, but they approached us in wanting to improve their prenatal education materials on their Right to Know website, and we took a look at what they had had historically, and we thought we could help them improve that. They asked permission to use the widgets, and of course the widgets are available to anybody all the time. We don't pick and choose who uses them. But we basically saw what they were doing and tried to help them and gave them some helpful facts and development highlights to improve the materials about prenatal development, and they were happy to use them, and they're now on the Kansas website for that purpose.
And other states have used portions as well.
That's true. North Carolina has used some of the development facts and Louisiana so far, and we're hoping that other state governments will use take advantage of these materials in whatever form they're teaching them in. But we just want to help governments teach prenatal development effectively and accurately. There's a lot of misinformation out there on the Internet. There's a lot of mistakes out there and wrong terminology, and we'd like to remedy those things and get people understanding the material, using the right terms, understanding what the images look like, and so forth. So that's what we do.
Well, the Endowment for Human Development has done just fabulous work. Gene and I were really impressed when we sit down and appreciated you coming by. You were in the area and we had heard about you from one of our members and came by and just sit down and gave us a walk through all these fabulous resources and wanted to make sure that our members knew they were available, and we're just excited to do that. What's ahead, Brian? I know you're always working on something, and what's the next step?
Well, we would like to put our pregnancy calendar, first of all, into about 50 or 100 languages, because Facebook, of course, has taken over the world, and it's a tremendous opportunity at modest cost to educate the whole Facebook community about normal human development and pregnancy and all the wonders involved therein. So that's one of our focuses for the future, is to get this pregnancy calendar into as many languages as we can afford. We'd also like to make the virtual human embryo available in other languages, perhaps, and get this DVD out in other languages all over the world as well. So there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of ignorance out there to illuminate, as they say, and we're looking forward to the future with great anticipation.
Great. Brian, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy day and for your commitment to this. It's something that I believe is really going to change hearts and minds as people are educated and understand the wonderful magnificence of life and its development. So thank you for the work you do, and we're going to continue to make this available. Your video is available on our website and through Life and Health Resources. We've got widgets up so people can see this on the CMDA website as well. But I really encourage people to go to EHD, Endowment for Human Development, EHD.org, and take a look at this. I think you'll find some things that will not only amaze you, but give you some great tools to educate others. So, Brian, thanks for being with us.
Dave, thank you so much.
This video will amaze you, and you need to get a copy and take a look at it. It's something you should have in your office, and it's a great gift to school, public libraries, science teachers, you name it. They're very low cost and can make an enormous difference. When you got a video that's so good it's distributed by National Geographic, you know you've got a great tool in your hands. You know, one of the privileges in life is to know some of the Christian patriarchs in medicine. I think of Paul Brand and his wonderful book, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. I think of Ed Pellegrino, and now just retired in his 90s, who has set the pace in bioethics and seen in both secular and Christian circles with great respect for what he's accomplished. And when you think about life, I think about John Wilkie. John has been around through the whole history of abortion, and when people think of those who've made the greatest difference, he's at the top of the list. John is the president of Life Issues Institute for 10 years. He was president of National Right to Life. He actually helped start and then was the president of the International Right to Life Federation. He and his wife are authors of Why Can't We Love Them Both, which followed their very classic book, Handbook on Abortion, that was published in 1971. How classic? That book has been published in 21 different languages. They've lectured in over 85 countries. In the midst of all that, he practiced medicine for 40 years in Cincinnati. A remarkable man, just a privilege to have him here on our microphone, as he kind of walks us through the history of abortion and gives us some insights that'll help us as we move forward. John, it's great to talk to someone like you who has such a rich history in dealing with life issues. And today we really want to talk about abortion. We're looking back at 40 years. What do you see and what has happened since Roe versus Wade or even before then as we look at this whole abortion battle we've been dealing with?
Well, you know, the clouds were gathering back in even in the early 50s. In the various religious denominations, we were seeing revolt. That is, I don't have to do what I've been told to do. We, particularly in the Catholic field, we saw a lot of nuns apostatize and leave. But that wasn't there alone. It was in others, too. By the end of the 60s, there was quite a move to just plain forget about all these old religious hang-ups. And particularly, also, we really don't have to worry too much about taking care of unborn babies, because we've learned that more information about how they start. And anyway, we're in sort of a hippie mood. And so Barbara and I came upon this. We had lectured in the field of sex education for over 10 years. We had written a bestseller and lectured nationally. But then the whole business of abortion becoming legal in several of the states. The two big states in the late 60s were California and New York. And so in response to that, we began to lecture in this field, and we wrote Handbook on Abortion. Now, Handbook on Abortion was published in 71. Within a year, it had sold 1 million copies.
Wow.
Before it was done, it went into, well, it's just going into its 22nd language. But it was a trailblazer. It was something that hadn't been there before. And we approached it not from a purely religious standpoint, it's a sin, but rather from a medical, a hygienic view. This is scientific. This is a baby, yes. Newfound information. A living human from that first cell stage. When's the first cell stage? Well, at fertilization. And we preached this doctrine to a, I'd say, an inquisitive nation. And Barbara and I then put out some slides. Pretty soon we had a slide set. More handbook on abortions. They went to several million copies. And what we did then was traipse across the nation. You know, pick your city. I don't know, just out of the blue, let's take Omaha. We'd be invited to talk in Omaha. All right, we gave our slide sets to Omaha. We left them behind. We trained a cadre of speakers, and then we went on to the next city. In a period of about 5 or 8 years, we spoke in every major city in the United States and began, I guess, we as much as anybody, were responsible for the beginning of the pro-life movement.
What was your feeling when Roe versus Wade came down? Because, I mean, that happened right during that period. You kind of saw it coming, but were you surprised when it happened?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was in Houston at the time, and I was walking on stage for an hour interview with a Planned Parenthood lady. And they handed me a note.
Wow.
Roe v. Wade. Wow. Well, that day I was on, I think, 18 different radio and TV shows before the last bell rang. And from there on in, it was just one madhouse that led to overseas. We ended up lecturing in 85 countries. And we sort of were a pioneer, I guess. We set up the prototype way of speaking about it. And we created the slide sets, which still are known as the Wilkie slides internationally, which, of course, we don't use in slides anymore, but for about 20 years, they were the coin of the realm.
Talk about strategies for trying to reverse this. I know, you know, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in the 70s, the real focus was more on, can we overturn this? Can we get a constitutional amendment, et cetera? Then, you know, in the 80s and early 90s, begin to be turned towards more, can we limit this? Can we incrementally shut this down over time and get smaller victories leading to a bigger victory? Is that correct, or how do you see the strategies that were going on in those days?
We had abortion on request for 9 months for any reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it was after the Supreme Court decision. Now, nobody knew that. We kept saying that, but the media across the country simply ignored it. And abortion is legal till 3 months, period, end of paragraph. Don't even think about it after that. And then came partial birth abortion.
Mm-hmm.
This took 10 years to get this law passed. And however, those were not 10 wasted years. These were the 90s, because they were educational years, and they educated a nation that it was legal until birth. When the nation was educated to the fact that we had a viable baby halfway through pregnancy, then they said, well, hey, then we don't think you ought to kill them that late. And from here on in, we have been slowly making more and more progress. From almost 16 million abortions, we're down to 12. And for a lot of reasons, we're hemming them in right now. The next move is the one that Ohio has pioneering, and that is after there's a heartbeat. Well, all of these things are moving in our direction. And that 20-week limit looks to me like in another year or two it's going to be the latest anybody can do an abortion. Well, that's a big advance.
I agree with you, John. I mean, we're just today was reading about one of the states, you know, they had 20 weeks abortion ban from that point on, and the courts upheld it. So
yeah.
I think we're beginning to increment it back, and we're seeing more and more people opposed to abortion, and the numbers are more in our favor now than ever. And I think many in the younger generation are seeing that abortion's not the answer, as it was promised to be.
Guys like you and the Christian Med Association has been a major part of this. Without your support, without the support of your members, we wouldn't be getting anywhere at all. Your organization, or I should say ours, has been a major, major component of the move toward protection for unborn babies.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, John, and we want to be in that battle. I don't think there's any greater battle than to protect human life. We must stand up and be voices for righteousness. John, I want to thank you for all you've done, your faithfulness over so many years, going clear back into the 60s when you started this over, 50 years ago now. And you've been that faithful voice, a mentor and an example to so many of us, I know to me as well. And I just want to let you know that how much I appreciate it, and I know how much each of our members that are listening to this appreciate you being that giant in the land, fighting for truth, speaking for righteousness, and not only here in this country, but all over the world. So we sure appreciate and love you.
Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure to associate with guys like you and to be part of the team that started a lot of this and kept it going. And our turn is obviously just about finished. But God bless what you're doing.
Yes, it is our turn to be picking up the mantle from these patriarchs like John Wilkie and carrying the flag as we move forward in speaking out for life. And I want to encourage you, you know, there's a lot of people out there that'll attack you if you speak out for life. But that's what God wants us to do. The Bible teaches it very clearly that we must be a voice for righteousness. We must be a voice for truth. And that God goes with us. We don't have to be afraid. I mean, just as David stood before Goliath, God has called us to protect the innocent, to speak out for the orphan, for the motherless. Be assured that God goes with you, and He gives us the power. He gives us the peace in the midst of the storm. He gives us the patience for the long haul. God is with us as we do these things. So be bold. Get involved at your local level, your national level. Speak out at your hospital. Speak out in your practice. Speak out through your church. Work in your public schools. Support your local crisis pregnancy center. As we do this together, the power that we have as healthcare professionals will be added to this battle. And God will bless you for it because He wants us to do it. And be assured that we here at CMDA stand with you. As you pass this special volume on to your friends, if there are other resources you or they need, just have them go to cmda.org or give us a call at 888-230-2637. We've got books and videos and PowerPoint presentations and a host of things, fact sheets that can be helpful on a wide range of life issues. We stand ready to help and to increase your influence in your community and across this country. That's our goal. That's what we want to be about. Well, God bless you as you continue to serve Him. Be assured, you're in our prayers.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.